It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's hard to have a discussion about football these days without the topic of concussions coming up. The National Football League has agreed to pay $765 million to settle a lawsuit brought by more than 5,000 players and their families. But how is the NFL addressing the problem and attempting to correct it? What research is available? And these questions aren't just being asked at the professional level, but from youth leagues all the way up through high school, where the number of athletes playing football is dwindling. An annual survey by the National Federation of State High School Associations showed that 25,000 fewer kids played football in the U.S. last year than only 4 years before. I'm joined now in Studio A by Dr. Anthony Kontos, Assistant Director of Research for UPMC's Concussion Program. Dr. Kontos, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me today.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. If you are a parent of a child who is playing organized tackle football, what concerns do you have about their safety? Have you forbidden your child from playing organized football? And if so, why? And we'd also like to hear from anyone who is dealing with the after effects of a concussion brought on by football or some other contact sport. 412-246-2002, the number to call. Dr. Anthony Kontos, where do we stand in terms of the latest research on the impact of concussions?
Well, that's a great question. And that's one of our main focuses at UPMC and the University of Pittsburgh, is to really bring evidence to this argument and discussion. Recently, we focused on the youth level, where we really knew very little about concussion. In particular, we looked at football, and we were focused on the kids that are, you know, really young, Pop Warner kind of USA football, below age 12. Previously, we've looked at high school, college, and we kind of inferred down to youth, but we really didn't know what was going on at that level, and we thought it was critically important to learn a little bit about what was going on down there. And what we learned in a study that focused on Western and Central PA teams, about 500 kids in our study, we learned that concussions are occurring primarily in games. Really wouldn't be a surprise to most people, but we needed to have data to show exactly when these injuries were happening and then, you know, what was the risk in practice and what were some of the reasons for these injuries. And what we found is there are very few of these injuries, concussions, occurring in practice, and most of them occur in games. Most of them involve the slightly older kids, the 11 to 12-year-old kids compared to the 8 to 10. There's not a lot of tackling going around at that age. You see a lot of the sort of bobblehead kids running around and really sort of falling into tackles versus the more purposeful tackles we see at the slightly older ages.
As you do study cases generally at the Pop Warner level, and parents do tend to bring up questions about their children and safety, should parents wait to put their children into contact sports such as hockey and football until a certain age?
That's a great question. And we didn't necessarily answer that question with our research. But what I can say about what we did learn, and again, I'm focusing on the evidence, not the conjecture that's out there. But what I believe that's important here is that when we looked at the kids 8 to 10, we didn't see a lot of concussions. In fact, there were only two in that age group. And with that in mind and the fact that there was such minimal contact occurring, we don't necessarily think that that's a risky activity per se, no more risky than other sports such as youth soccer, youth lacrosse, or youth ice hockey.
And as long as you've mentioned hockey and lacrosse, which are definitely contact sports, and even soccer to some degree is as well, is there a certain age that parents should maybe wait to put their kids into those sports? One of the questions that comes up, for example, is, are concussions more dangerous at certain ages than others?
Yeah, that's another really good question. And, you know, as we're learning more and more about the brain and the effects of this injury on the brain, we know that there is a potential risk for younger kids. However, we're not sure just yet from our research perspective at what age we may see a risk increase. We do know that younger kids tend to have more problems with this injury, maybe with lesser force than we might see with older kids, where there's a selection effect too. And that's another thing that's important to bear in mind here, is that as you go on in level of sport, you're also getting kids that are more resilient to injuries in general and maybe concussions as well. And that kind of self-selection all the way up to like the NFL level can certainly drive some kids out of that sport versus, you know, continuing to play that sport. With that in mind, however, I don't think we set an age cutoff. I think that's more of a developmental issue. And kids generally at around age 8 are ready to start to play some developmental type organized youth sport. Anything below that, I think, would certainly not be appropriate.
And are some of the risks involved when kids are a younger age, say, you know, 10 or below, or let's say preteen years, is it because the brain is in a stage of development at that point?
Yeah, the hypothesis is that, you know, the brain is still developing. There's a lot of endocrine activity, hormone activity, and this development in the brain and the immaturity of the brain may make it more vulnerable. However, there's a contrary argument that suggests that that younger brain is also more plastic or malleable. It can change and respond to insults such as injury much better than a brain that's older or more crystallized. So there is kind of a yin-yang argument there.
Well, whether it's on the battlefield or the football field, it seems unlikely that we would be seeing more concussions today as opposed to decades ago, because of the helmet technology that's available. Yet it seems to be more of a concern now than it was years ago when football players were wearing leather helmets, or in some cases, you know, no helmets at all, just long hair to pad themselves from the blows. Why now are we hearing more about
this? Well, it's interesting that you draw the analogy to the old helmets, because there was a biomechanics study looking at the old leather helmets and how well they dissipated the force compared to the new technology helmets, and found that those old helmets were actually somewhat effective, a lot more effective than we initially thought at dissipating the forces that might cause concussion or other more serious injuries like a skull fracture. That aside, I think what we're seeing here is really an awareness piece, and that's that we're more able to recognize this injury. We're more in tune with it, not only coaches, players, but also parents and medical professionals are just doing a better job recognizing this injury. And I think when you do that, just like with anything, whether it's cancer of some sort or another injury like an ACL where everyone's aware of it, they start to recognize it and diagnose it more, you're going to see a spike in the numbers of those.
Do you ever wonder how football players, for example, or a hockey player years ago, how they, you know, we've all seen those scenes in the movies where the guy gets hit in the head and he's woozy and the coach is yelling at him and saying, well, get back in there, you
yeah.
idiot. Did you ever wonder, you know, how many concussions players might have had that went undiagnosed?
Yeah, I'm sure there are some players, particularly in sports like hockey, ice hockey, and football, where there was a greater likelihood that they would be struck in the head, where they had many what we would now diagnose as a concussion. But back then, you know, it was how many fingers am I holding up? Let's get the smelling salts out. And if you're not knocked out or, you know, have lost consciousness, you really didn't have a concussion. And as you're probably well aware, they were referred to as dings, or I had my bell rung, which we now know those were really concussions. And only 10% of concussions involve loss of consciousness. So when you think about that, Paul, you're thinking only 10% were probably being noticed back then. 90% were being maybe undiagnosed or not recognized as the injury that we now recognize today.
I mentioned that a lot of parents are concerned. We're seeing less kids going out for football, and many families, many parents are reluctant to let their children play organized contact, full contact football. Are they overreacting to some of the new data, some of what we now know about concussions?
Well, I think there's a sort of knee-jerk response that we see, and this mimics what we hear in the NFL or the collegiate game, and it kind of filters down to the lower levels of sport. And I think with the lawsuit in the NFL and this other highlights of concussion in these sports, you're certainly seeing a knee-jerk response. The problem is, to date, that there's been no data to look at these younger kids, and our study being one of the first studies to look at concussion in these really younger age groups just shows how much more we need to know. I mean, we just did one study. We need a lot more data to really make informed decisions about what's safe and what's not safe for our kids to play.
Most people in the Pittsburgh area hear the word concussion and have flashbacks of Sidney Crosby missing 61 games. But it seems that concussions in the NFL don't keep players out for more than a game or two. Help us understand this. What are the major differences between concussions that cause lengthy absences and concussions that cause relatively short absences?
Well, we're learning a lot about that very question. And one of the things we learn is that everybody brings a set of sort of constitutional risk factors to the table, and that might include something like their own concussion history, if they've had a lot of concussions in the past. Maybe they have a migraine history in their family or a personal history of that, and that could also be a risk factor. We also know that, you know, as we've mentioned already today, age may play a role in that. We're learning that sex may also play a role via a couple different vehicles, neck strength being one of those potentially. But more importantly, we're learning which factors when you get injured might drive you down a longer recovery. Now, one good example of those in a recent study we published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine showed that post-traumatic migraine, so that would be headache with nausea and then also with sensitivity to light or noise, if you have that cluster of symptoms, you're about 6.5 times more likely than someone who doesn't have those symptoms to have a long recovery of 21 days or greater. So it's not only what you bring to the table, but it's also how does that injury manifest in the first maybe week following the injury or even in the first few hours. And what we've also learned in a previous study a couple years ago was that dizziness at the time of injury plays a big role in how long your recovery will be, much like post-traumatic migraine. If you have dizziness on field at the time of injury, again, you are about 6 times more likely to have a longer recovery than those who did not.
The dizziness, though, can come later, right?
That's true. But in our study, we only were focused on dizziness that occurred at that immediate time period right after injury. And in that other study I mentioned, we also looked at dizziness, but it didn't play as big a role once it was a week later.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Dr. Anthony Kontos, Assistant Director of Research for UPMC's Concussion Program. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We'll take your comments and questions when we return to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking about concussions and contact sports, football in particular. And we'd like to hear from you on this topic with our guest, Dr. Anthony Kontos, who is Assistant Director of Research for UPMC's Concussion Program. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. The email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. If you're a parent of a child who's playing organized tackle football, we'd like to hear about your concerns about their safety and whether or not you've forbidden your child from playing organized football. We'd also like to hear from anyone who is dealing with the after effects of a concussion brought on by contact sports, football, hockey, lacrosse, or some other sport. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Dr. Kontos, can you describe what actually occurs with a person's head and brain when they're suffering a hit that leads to a concussion?
Yeah, I think it's important to first talk about the forces. And you have a direct force or a linear force that could involve what we call an acceleration-deceleration, where the brain inside the skull is moving forward and backward. And what happens there is the brain is going to be moving inside the skull, which isn't nice and smooth, and so there's some bony protuberances, and it kind of gets raked across a bit at a very rapid rate. In addition, you may have a rotational impact, which is a little bit more offset, like where you see the quarterback's head snapping or a player getting checked and their head snapping sideways. And what you see there is, again, a rotation where the skull rotates, and then quickly the brain follows, and then the skull goes back, and the brain sort of returns back to where it's normally supposed to be. When this happens, there's everything from axonal shearing to metabolic changes. And those metabolic changes involve essentially what we would like to refer to as an energy crisis in the brain. So there's a demand for energy. At the same time, there's an energy shutdown, more or less. And that is really what results in then the effects that we call a concussion.
What you're describing has been absolutely glorified in things like NFL films, where you years ago, and you still see it somewhat today, they slow-mo, they'll show a slow-motion shot of a quarterback being hit on his blind side. He's looking the other way, getting ready to throw the ball, and there's a 300-pound defensive lineman bearing down on him, and you see the head action that you're describing and the neck and the head snapping back. The NFL is looking for ways to protect the brain. Is there a way to do that in a sport where you have that kind of contact and where collisions are not only encouraged but glorified?
Well, you bring up several good points, and one that would be the next step in my discussion of what a concussion is, and that's that it doesn't necessarily involve a direct hit. The hit you're talking about, the blindside hit, often is to the back or the lower part of the back, and the head doesn't ever get contacted, but what you have is a whiplash-type injury, much like what you might get in a car accident because of your seatbelt. And in both cases, you could have the best helmet in the world on, and in fact, a heavier helmet would make it worse in those instances. And the reality is that you can't really prevent concussions. They're going to happen, whether it's in soccer, ice hockey, lacrosse, volleyball, you name it, it can happen. So to think that we can truly prevent them is probably a bit of a misconception.
How can athletes and parents of younger athletes try to prevent concussions from happening? Are there precautions that they might be able to take that you might not see the pros taking?
Well, I think some of the best precautions are learning really good technique and developing good strength in the neck and upper back, but really focusing on doing things properly. And one of the great examples here would be tackling. Traditionally, tackling has been taught in a manner that really wasn't a progressive approach. And more recently, we've seen groups such as USA Football with their Heads Up tackling program really try to focus this on a learning step by step where you're building up to a full fledged tackle. Whereas, back when we played sports, it was more, hey, here we go. This is what it looks like. Go do it. And I think really what we're learning now is that we need to teach these younger kids proper technique where they're tucking, where they're getting their head out of the way, where they're learning to tackle in a way that's not going to put their head at risk. At the same time you're doing all that, you still have to realize that any sport is going to have the potential risk for there to be an unexpected collision or a ball hit them in the face in a sport like soccer or something like that could still result in a concussion.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Anthony Contos with UPMC's concussion program. We have Tom in Imperial ready to join the program. Tom, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, what I'm calling about is I am 55 and played football since I was in mighty midgets. And I suffer from being diagnosed with depression, anxiety, very poor memory. What I'm interested in is understanding the way to diagnose if I have had an effect from playing football and the concussions, which I was hospitalized twice for in high school. And then what can I do now? Alzheimer's is an issue in my family, and I'm just concerned and looking for what I can possibly do to help myself.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for your question. You bring up a couple of really good points. You mentioned first a family potential family risk profile, which is important to know, and certainly a licensed medical professional, physician or neuropsychologist, getting in to see them and getting a full workup and history and also some neuropsychological testing, as well as many other assessments that are done for this injury and also some of the other things that you mentioned there. And then being able to sort of pull apart what might be related to the injury and then what might just be a product of other factors as well. But certainly a good first step would be to go see a licensed, trained neuropsychologist, someone in that area to get a good evaluation.
Tom, thank you for the I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom. Did you have a follow-up?
No, I just want to make sure. It's neuropsychologist, correct?
Yeah, that's certainly one option. It would be a licensed clinical neuropsychologist like we have at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Sports Medicine Concussion Program. But you could also see any number of physicians. Could certainly start at your PCP, your primary care, to get an idea of what's going on, and then they could refer you out to an appropriate professional.
Okay.
Tom, thank you for the call, and good luck to you. Dr. Contos, you talked about the impact of hurry-up offenses on concussions in Sports Illustrated. Do you still believe that this system of offense can be detrimental to players' health when it comes to concussions?
Well, I think in that article, and I was quoted, it's really saying more of what its effects would be on fatigue, which could then indirectly affect the likelihood of injury in particular. And I think it's important to note that when your players are given less time to rest in between plays, and there's potentially players out there for multiple plays, like 18 plays in a row, and they're not getting a break at all, and they're not ready for this because that's not how they normally play, I think you do run the risk of potentially due to fatigue. They're a little more distractible. They're maybe not as attentive to their environment. They don't pick up the guy coming on their blind side, that sort of thing. And certainly there is the potential risk there. Although to directly say that would cause an increase in concussions, it's hard to say without looking at data, which we don't have any data right now about that.
Are there any instances in sports such as kickoffs in football that tend to put players at a higher risk for concussions?
Yeah, there's been some good research out of the University of North Carolina in this area by Kevin Guskowitz and colleagues. And in fact, that research was used to drive some of the changes in the NFL and collegiate game with regard to the kickoff distance. And I think, you know, what you saw was a higher rate of concussions per exposure in those high velocity. You're having players running the full length of the field and then, you know, more or less just colliding into each other, whether they're blocking or they're going after the back who has the ball in their return. And I think by shortening that distance and, frankly, by reducing the numbers of those carries altogether, by if you just watched the game last night, they're getting kicked out of the end zone, you know, 5 out of 6 times now. So that's going to reduce the number of times that, you know, an athlete might be exposed and certainly would probably reduce concussion in the long term.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Barbara in Pittsburgh. Barbara, you're on with Dr. Anthony Kontos of UPMC's concussion program.
Yes. Okay. I received, I had a car accident February 12th of this year, and the symptoms got very bad 2 weeks later, and I am still to this day on medical leave from my job. I'm still incapacitated. I can go out and drive now, which I couldn't do for a couple months. And I have very limited energy. Right at the present time, my head is feeling fragile. Sometimes I even have to stop talking because of the way my brain feels inside or my head. Why is it taking so long for this for me to recover from this?
That's a good question, Barbara. And one thing to first rule out is anything that's more serious that could be going on, such as a subdural bleed or any other intracranial pathological issue. And I think that would be one thing through a CAT scan or an MRI. And once that was ruled out for you, you know, you have to realize that these injuries do vary in how long they take to recover. And some people with certain risk factors may take longer to recover. And another thing you mentioned, you know, you kind of had this 2 week period and then things got worse. And one question might be, what happened during that 2 week period? Did you exert yourself maybe physically or cognitively in a way that was too demanding for where you were with your injury? What we've seen with a lot of our young athletes, if they're not managed properly early on with the injury, if they're not given an appropriate amount of activity to be involved in cognitively and physically, they can sometimes exacerbate their injury due to the, you know, overtaxing of that energy crisis.
But are you still there, Barbara?
I still am here. I'd like to know what I should go from here. I've had some scans done of my brain, and they came out clean. So is it a matter of just giving it time?
Yeah, and those scans typically are clean. In fact, 95% of CAT and MRI scans following a concussion will show no evidence of any kind of abnormality. So that's not atypical. However, it's important to note that there are other ways to measure your injury, including some of the cognitive neuropsychological assessments that are out there, vestibular assessments, ocular motor assessments, all of which could be something that you're having issues with that could lead to or exacerbate your symptoms, your headache, et cetera. So again, as I mentioned to the first caller, I think it's important that you get referred into an appropriate clinic to get some good follow-up care so that we can pinpoint what's going on with an injury like this and get you down a course of treatment that will be most effective.
Dr. Kontos, do you share your research with groups like the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University in conjunction with the Sports Legacy Institute?
I'm sorry, do we share it with them directly?
Right.
Well, I think, you know, our research is being disseminated in journals, and that's where we more or less share it. But we certainly do at professional meetings. There's no direct conduit between us and that group, but we certainly are collegial with those researchers, and we work together with them in a variety of different ways in our profession.
Dr. Anthony Kontos is Assistant Director of Research for UPMC's Concussion Program. Dr. Kontos, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. It was my pleasure to be here.